from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and today on Write the Book, you're going to hear me talk to Robin Green, who has a new book with Little Brown, The Only Girl, My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. Robin Green and I are going to be speaking live in just 1 second here, and I'm looking forward to it quite a bit. Robin Green, I'm not reading her full bio right now because I just want to get to the interview, but you're going to hear about her work on the Rolling Stone magazine and her work also writing for television, including such shows as Northern Exposure and The Sopranos. So I'm very excited to talk to her. Robin, are you there?
My husband and I are teaching television writing for the semester at the University of Iowa in connection with the theater department here and the workshop also. That's where I am.
Okay.
But I'm here.
That's fantastic. So you're going back to your roots because you used to study at Iowa.
Well, I went to the writer's workshop and I met Mitch here. So we are giving back, as they say,
yeah.
Visiting the scene of the crime, you know.
Okay, that's fantastic. How long are you there for?
The whole semester until December.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I've really enjoyed reading The Other Girl, My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. And so I thought that we could start out talking about the fact that The Only Girl covers a lot of ground, much of which takes place in the 70s. And so I wondered why now was the time to write the book.
Why now? Excuse me, I didn't hear the first part.
Oh,
why now?
Why was this the best time for you to write this book? Why did you decide it was
time? Well, you know, one thing was someone asked me to.
Oh, okay, that's always helpful.
I always respond very well to that. And I realized that I had always wanted to do it. And I had the time to do it. You know, we'd done 25 years of television. We'd created our own show. It was going fine without us, and I found myself with time to do something like this, and it was as if I'd been waiting my whole life to do it. It just was the most wonderful experience to write this book. It was very different from all the other writing that I've done my whole life, my whole long life.
Yeah, I don't think that it's been a super long life, but certainly you've accomplished a lot. So I'm actually opening a website here, and I see a different cover. How many covers are there for The Only Girl?
There's just two. The UK used a different photo of me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that's the UK version. It's out in Virago Books.
Oh, okay.
In the UK.
All right, great. Yeah. So the full title of the book is The Only Girl, My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the importance of the masthead, particularly maybe at that time.
Oh, gee. You know, I loved Rolling Stone. I just read it, you know, religiously and avidly. Went first on the west and the east coast in New York, and then I moved out to California, and just the idea of working there was fine with me. I would have done anything there, but I got the opportunity to write a story for them, and so I did, and I, you know, I had no journalistic training, but I wrote 10,000 words of something.
Yeah.
And they put it on the cover, and then that was not my first article published, because they saved that cover until the summer, and the first article, I think, was in the winter before. And so once I'd written a few articles, I was put on the masthead, and it wasn't until many years later that I looked back with a woman who asked me to write the book, who had worked at the magazine then, and who remembered me from those years, that it really struck me that I really was the only woman writer contributing editor on the masthead for 3 years, the 3 years that I was there,
right,
from 71 to 73. And then even after that, if my name hadn't been taken off the masthead, I still wrote for the magazine, and there just weren't that many women writing for it.
Yeah.
Also, because it had a 10% female readership, so, you know, that it sort of made sense that there weren't that many women eager to write for it.
Although I imagine that as the women's names grew on the masthead, the women's readership probably grew somewhat consistently with that. I wonder if as more names were on, women's names were on the masthead, there was also more women readership.
Yes, I think that's true.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that you write about in The Only Girl is having become, I'm going to say, a witch, because there are certain things I'm not going to say on the radio at 3 o'clock, but having become a witch by reputation. And I'm just wondering, did you think that was fair in retrospect, or do you think that was fair in retrospect, and also how did you react to that reputation?
You know, what happened was, you know, after my first article, it was my second article was published. It was about Dennis Hopper.
Yes.
And maybe I wasn't especially kind to him, but he wasn't very kind to me either.
Yeah, no, that's a wonderful anecdote in the book, and he was not at all kind to you. He didn't even know you were there.
He was mean to everybody. And after that was published, it was really sort of a groundbreaking piece in a way, because it really set Hollywood on its head. It made PR, unfortunately, it made PR people more afraid of journalists. But it's in this compendium of 10 articles that shook Hollywood.
Okay.
And I was the third, you know, after like Truman Capote and another renowned writer.
Oh, good for you.
Who published before me? Yeah. I actually forgot what the question was.
Just, you know, how you reacted to having that reputation.
Oh, yeah. You know. So after that, that's right, I'm sorry. So
no worries.
After that, I just came from teaching my class. I'm teaching writing at the University of Iowa.
Yeah.
And so I'm distracted a bit, but I'll settle down in a minute.
No, that's fine.
But after that article was published, an editor at Esquire called Rolling Stone magazine and said, "Who's the new witch?" I guess we'll call me. And I took it as a compliment.
Yeah.
It's so stupid. But I did. I took it as a compliment. Just to be noticed by Esquire was great. And I just thought, you know, I took it as, you know, one of the millennials at Little Brown who read my manuscript called me a badass. Can you say that on your program?
I guess we can now. I think we can.
I took it as a compliment.
Yeah.
I did. I mean, I didn't really stop to think about what that really meant, and I didn't even detect at the time the sexism in it.
Well, but the other thing is that you were setting out to have a tone in your articles that was somewhat irreverent and maybe taking a different look at things than people were used to. Is that fair, do you think?
Yes, I think that is fair. I think that's why Jan hired me, because when I went in to interview with him, you know, I'd gone to look for a secretarial job with the name of someone an old college friend had given me, and he said, "Your friend said that you're a writer. Why don't you go talk to Jan?" And it had never occurred to me that I could write for the magazine. That just wasn't even an idea in my head. When I went to my interview with him, he asked me, I had been Stan Lee's secretary at Marvel Comics before.
Yes.
I got out to California. And so he asked me about Marvel Comics and asked me what it was like to work for. And I was a very shy person, and I didn't really talk much in those days, but no one really asked me any questions. But he had asked me this question, so I told him what I was actually thinking, and I guess that I have a kind of ironic view of things, or I describe the place in ironic tones, and so I think immediately that became my beat.
Yeah.
The beat was irony. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I think that's yeah, that was one of my questions for you too, but I don't know if now that you're you have a little bit more to look back on and think about, what was it like working for Stan Lee at Marvel Comics? Was it fun? Was it just a job?
It was, first of all, I'd gone to New York to be in publishing. And you know, the employment agency that I went to, they said, New York is flooded with American literature majors like yourself who want to be in publishing. There's no hope for you. And they sent me on to two advertising agencies and to Marvel comic books. And I'd never read a comic book, but I really didn't like the ad agencies. It was much too corporate for me.
Yeah.
And Marvel, because I was sort of a hippie, not really yet, but It was just uptight, you know, at the advertising agency.
Yeah.
Marvel was not uptight. It was very relaxed, and people were friendly and warm and juvenile.
Yeah.
Even though they were, you know, seemed old to me. They were in their 30s and 40s and things, the artists and the writers. And Stan himself, who is a good, you know, couple decades older than me, probably.
Yeah,
but it was a very warm and fun atmosphere. And so I took that job.
Yeah. Which is,
and it was wonderful to work there.
It's wonderful to say that. I mean, you've had some amazing jobs. Your CV is just
Zelig.
Much fun.
You know, I just was there for so many of these cultural phenomena.
Yeah, you totally were. I think
so much of luck, life is luck, you know.
Right, yeah. Now, you describe, I love this story, you describe having gone to your Rolling Stone interview with Alan Rintzler. First of all, you wore casual clothes, but not just casual clothes. You also, on the back of your, I think, denim jacket was like some sort of patch that depicted like a sex act or something. And you also brought your boyfriend's dog to the interview. I mean, you were just really going to be, you know, either they take me as I am or they don't get me at all. So that was so awesome. Can you just talk a little bit about your thinking and why you decided to do that?
Because I just thought, I'm not putting on my secretarial disguise. And then I've gotten so many jobs like that in Boston, in New York, in Chicago. And I just thought, you know what, I'm just going to wear my own clothes, see what happens. And I took the dog. I did. Took the dog.
Reuben.
Insanity. It was, yeah, it was just the times too, you know, it was 1970 and all bets were off. And I get to the office, and it's in this converted warehouse in this cool section of nobody, you know, was in this industrial section yet, down on, I think, 3rd Avenue or 3rd Street. And an old coffee brewing, you know, a coffee baking house, like Maxwell's or something.
Yeah.
And it stank of coffee. And so I get out of the elevator and I'm shown into Alan's office, into the editor's office that my friend had given me his number. And he had his dog there, too.
Oh, that's perfect.
And it was just perfect. His dog was named Pushkin, of course. You know, it was very classier than my dog.
I think Reuben is a classy name.
Yeah, kind of. But he was a mutt.
Yeah.
And Alan's dog was a purebred poodle, I think, an unclipped poodle.
Yeah. Now, this is kind of a little bit of an aside, but it's interesting to me that the book Marjorie Morningstar has now come up twice in interviews that I've done with guests in recent months. And I've never read this book, but the other was a memoir on writing by Anne Hood. I guess Marjorie Morningstar was a big inspiration to her at a certain point in time. So why is this book important to you?
Because I identified with the character.
Yeah.
It was the 50s. She was a 50s girl.
Mm-hmm.
And like me, she had, you know, vague fan. Well, she wanted to be an actress, I think, and her name was Marjorie Morgenstern.
Okay, right.
And I was a Jewish girl I wasn't from New York. She was from the West Side, but I was, you know, a Jewish girl from the East Side of Providence, Rhode Island, from a very, you know, kind of a golden ghetto kind of situation, although we didn't have any money. But I just identified with her. She was someone who changed her name, moved down to the village, and had, you know, affairs and sex and things. And I just thought it sounded so, you know, glamorous.
Yeah.
To me. Of course, she ended up marrying a doctor and moving to Scarsdale. But I conveniently forgot that part of the book. But
well, I think you've had a more interesting life. Let's see. So you did mention, and you mentioned in the book, that you have a brother in Vermont. So I'm just curious, have you spent a lot of time in Vermont, and is he still here?
And what here? I'm sorry?
Is your brother still here?
Oh, yeah. My brother went to medical school at the University of Vermont in Burlington, where you are.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And he never went home. He never came back to Rhode Island.
That happens to a lot of people here.
Yes. He married his, you know, girlfriend Sue from when he was in college, and they have lived their entire lives either in Norwich, Vermont, or you know, he's worked at Dartmouth his whole career. He was the head of resident psychiatry there, and all, you know, he's a neuroscientist, and now he has a private practice on Main Street in Hanover, New Hampshire, and they live, you know, in a beautiful Charles Platt house, 20 minutes south of Hanover. So that's where he lives.
Okay.
He lives this beautiful New England idyllic life.
Now,
I visit him often.
When you're not in Iowa, are you in New York?
Oh, yeah. We live in Greenwich Village, and then we spend the winters in St. John.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. We rent a house down there, so yeah. We've done that for a long time, and that's where I wrote the book.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the book has a lot of detail to it. Were you a diary keeper or someone who just took actually, at one point you say you have a really great memory for stuff. So is that how you recalled all this?
Here's the thing. The stories in that book are the stories of my life, and they're the stories that I would tell people.
Oh, okay.
Stuff that happened to me over the, 50 or 70 years that the book covers of my life. I wrote the book at 70. And that's another reason why I wrote it, is that when you turn 70, you know, you're at the top of the hill and you can see the end.
Right.
And you realize that your time is limited in a way that you simply, I hadn't before. It just, there it was. And it was an opportunity, a great opportunity to just sum it all up. It just was a rush. I realized that I've been waiting forever to write this book. It was supposed to be about Rolling Stone, but it was impossible to tell about it without telling everything.
Yeah.
So I told everything.
Yeah.
And it told me how to tell it. It was the most interesting writing experience. I've never done anything that long, and I've never had an experience like this of a sustained nature. And the process of writing this book was so exciting and exhilarating because it had its own process. It dictated to me how it would lay out. Whenever I tried to control it or start what I thought was a terrific beginning for a chapter, can I say BS detector would go off?
Sure. Thank you for being so careful.
I'm trying, but it's hard for me. You know, I'm used to The Sopranos, where you can say anything.
I know, right?
And Rolling Stone. So.
So actually, no, I have a question for you about the way you wrote the book. So as long as we've already gotten here, this is sort of a question about craft and structure, and maybe it wasn't intentional, but sometimes you present us with like a short synopsis of some moment in your life, and then you kind of bounce back to the present storyline, but then later on you might expand on that event. So do you mind if I read a little paragraph?
I love it. I'm interested to see which one you would choose.
Oh, well, there are a lot. Yeah, it was something you did. This is an example. This is, I think, fairly early in the book. You wrote, in a few years after I'd gone to live with him in Chicago, he would leave me and go back to his wife. A few years after that, they'd divorce. He'd have other affairs at the office and an apartment in the Castro with a dentist chair in the living room and a tank of nitrous oxide nearby. In 1977, he'd move with Rolling Stone to New York, and in time become the kind of drunk who passed out on the curb, had his pocket razored and his wallet stolen, before he finally gave up booze and drugs and joined AA. New paragraph. But in 1971, we didn't know any of that. So this was something you would do, and it would intrigue me. I wanted that story, but I also wanted the story I'd been in before you got there. So I wondered if you can talk a little bit about giving us snapshots of what's to come, you know, either narratives that we'll see expanded or not.
Yeah, you know, that's what I was trying to explain. The book dictated its own terms to me.
It did.
Kind of unfolded to me, and that's what was so exciting about the process, that I had to learn patience, and I had to learn to let things unfold the way they would unfold.
Yeah.
And so it was a natural thing. Not that I didn't have to rewrite, don't get me wrong, but things unfolded in their own way.
Right.
And I let them. And so that just seemed to progress naturally out of what I was talking about. I just let that happen.
Okay. Yeah.
I did that I did it a few times. Maybe I did it too much. I don't know.
No, I didn't think you did it too much. I chose that one
because, well, first of all, because it kept occurring to me that I wanted to ask you this question. And then at that point, you actually mentioned a number of things. You went through a sort of whole storyline about this person, and I thought that was interesting. Let's see. Mm-hmm. Okay, so here's another moment that I thought.
And also I should add, I remember in college, I was a literature major, and I just remember, and then I took short story writing, and mostly it was an American literature class. I remember they talked about foreshadowing,
Sure.
And so I suppose that was something that I thought of as I was writing, and I don't think formally I thought, I think I'll foreshadow, but I think that I understood that it might be. And even in TV, maybe you give a taste of where the arc of the story is going to keep the reader or to tempt the reader. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
So there's some sort of process of like that happening.
I think another level on which it worked, which I've just thought of now, is that there are a lot of people in this book, and there are a lot of names and places and events, and maybe it just helps us because we've already seen a little snapshot of something when we get there, and so it's not as confusing as it might be if there were
hopefully so. Yes, I know what you're saying. When I read it over, I did the audiobook, I thought, God, there's an awful lot of guys named David.
There were, that's true.
how am I going to keep these Davids straight for the reader? Poor reader.
Well, luckily, some of them were
next
famous.
Next time, I'll know better.
Okay, so I want to read another little piece of it, if you don't mind.
I love it. It's fun for me.
Okay, good. So, I'm going to start out by prefacing this, by talking about why I'm reading this. A lot of the blurbs for the book focus on your humor and the 70s, wild times, and sort of indiscretions. And I think when a kind of tell-all memoir comes out, it's often sold on that tell-all aspect. But I don't think that your blurb said enough about your prose. I was glad to see that T.C. Boyle calls you an extraordinary writer. I think your prose is absolutely beautiful. This is just an example.
No, you're going to make me cry here.
No, you won't.
No, that's lovely to hear. Thank you so much. Well, okay, read it.
yeah. I'm going to share it with our listeners. So, for now, though, we were still on the train somewhere north of Guadalajara, stretched out on the slept-in sheets of the bed in our sleeping compartment, watching Mexico lumber by, nothing to see really but dirt and cactus and the occasional beat-up town. Every time the train stopped, sometimes in the collection of dusty sheds that constituted a town, sometimes in the middle of absolute nowhere, weathered men in serapes and sombreros would materialize at our window with tacos and warm beer and bottles of unlabeled liquor that tasted like burning tires smell. That was so good that they tasted like a smell. That was awesome. I loved that. The reason I laughed at serapes is that I have a cast on my arm and so I can't type. So I dictated all my questions and the dictation program totally didn't get serapes right.
So. Oh, that's funny.
So I got to it and I didn't know what it was. Anyway, that's all. I don't really have a question. I just think your prose is beautiful and you're an
thank you. Yeah. That makes me so happy.
Yeah. No, I have a feeling it wasn't just luck that got you all these great jobs. So.
Yeah. Well, I could write. I mean, that's what I discovered in college, that I could write, and that this was something that I was good at.
Yeah.
Let's say that. And that I was better at it than most of the other kids. I'll just say that to you.
Yeah,
it was true. And so I clung to it.
Yeah.
I never imagined in college that I would ever make my living that way. Because, for a girl like me, I went to Brown University, but I was a townie. I was the first generation of immigrants. Of an immigrant, family. My grandparents were immigrants, and they lived upstairs and all that go to college. So and Brown was in my hometown, so I marched up the hill. So to be a writer, to think that I could possibly, make my living that way was just out of my ken. It was just something I couldn't really conceive of.
Yeah.
I took typing so I could be a secretary. This was the 50s.
Right.
In high school and 60s in college, and girls, you know, maybe girls would go to New York and rise in publishing there, but even that was out of my reach.
Right, well, because you didn't have that particular job interview come up, but yeah, it's interesting.
So,
yeah.
I forget how we got into this, but I go off on these tangents.
No, it's all interesting. You were talking about how you had.
You were talking about my writing, and that's why I couldn't hold the compliment in my mind. But thank you very much.
Well,
very hard for me to hear a compliment.
I think another message for women, other than you can do more than you used to be allowed to do in the 50s, I think another important message for women to hear is you can own a compliment. You can own your qualities, and that's one of your qualities. Okay, Robin, I have a favor to ask you. I'm wondering if you can recount at least some sort of summarized version of your Hunter S. Thompson story about driving on Route 1. That was such a fantastic story.
Oh, boy. That was the Rolling Stone editorial conference of December 1971.
Okay.
And all of the men had gone down. I wasn't on retainer. I was told, I talked to Jan about this, Wenner, recently, and Paul Scanlon, and they said, you weren't on retainer. You weren't, you know, you didn't have a staff job at the magazine. That's why we didn't invite you. But really, it would have been ridiculous for me to be in that room in with all of those men, and there were like 20 of them in the picture, you know, and Hunter in his bathrobe and all that. So I came down on the second night when wives were invited. I was the girlfriend of my editor, and he invited me down.
Okay.
One other girl from the office who was in the business department.
All right.
So we were down there in Big Sur. God, Hunter had this rented car, this fast car, and it was me and my editor in the back seat, and Annie Leibovitz, the photographer, in the front seat riding shotgun, and Hunter was riding. He was driving. He had a bottle of Wild Turkey between his legs, and this on the console was a baggie full of blue pills, which were mescaline.
Yeah.
And he was just eating them, and we were all eating them, and he was driving. The idea was, if you have your lights off, I don't know if you know anything about Route 1
in
Big Sur.
Yeah.
It's a little curvy and windy and dangerous.
Yes.
So there's this huge, like, 100-foot cliff off to your left, you know. And he would take those curves wide. But he had the lights off because his theory was that he would better see the headlights of approaching cars. So he could go as fast as he wanted, see? There was no danger. Unless the other car had the same idea, then you were, you know, cooked.
Yeah.
And or if an animal should run into the road, you know. But we didn't die. It was very exhilarating.
I bet.
And I actually think I wrote that I didn't care if I died. I don't know. I probably didn't. I had a lot of mescaline. But anyway, then we got back to Esalen. And Esalen is this kind of new agey spa.
Right.
With spiritual overtones right on the water. And we descend these cliffs, and we go into kind of cave, but one side of it is open to the ocean. And in the cave are stone baths, and there we all were, naked, in these sulfur baths at night. It was like 2 a.m.
Right.
Everybody, pardon me?
Yeah, I hear. I'm listening, yep.
No, I mean, am I making this too long? It's like,
not at all.
It's one of the most wonderful experiences of my whole
life. No, it's an amazing story.
Well, it was so special. It was special. It was out there and crazy. But, you know, we were just in this kind of, I don't know if everyone was stoned on mescaline, but probably. And there was a lot of pot maybe, but I don't remember actually seeing any. But, and you couldn't smell anything but the sulfur from the sulfur bath.
Right.
But there was smoke arising around everybody, you know, when the hot water hit that cool night air.
Yeah.
And you could get out of the tub naked and just stand there by the side of the cliff and watch the ocean.
Oh, wow.
Because the heat of the mineral bath heated your skin in such a way, and maybe it was mescaline too, that you didn't feel anything. And
right.
So you didn't feel cold or anything. You just felt, you know, the water evaporating from your skin. It was just such a privilege to be standing there, stark naked.
Yeah.
No one really bothered you, or there wasn't that kind of stuff going on at all.
Right.
But, you know, the whole office was in the various, there were, I think, 4 baths in my memory, although maybe there were 3 or 2. But I remember looking out on the ocean And there was a full moon, you know, the streak of white from the moon in the water, and whales were migrating south.
Oh,
and because of the mescaline, it slowed everything down. So I could really see the whales emerge from the water in the moonlight and then, you know, fluke and dive back down in. And it was the peak moment of my life, you know. it was an amazing moment.
Yeah, it's...
And I should add that my first mescaline experience was in Vermont, in your home country, in the snow. So
I'm so proud.
I'm gonna bring it home to you. Those were the days.
Those were, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So here's I know that you are acquainted with, or eventually, I don't know, befriended Joan Didion. But she, you have quoted her in the book as saying that, I'm not going to get it exactly right, but when you write memoir, you're always selling somebody out. Or when, maybe it's just when you write.
Not memoir, particularly anything. Writers are always selling somebody out.
Okay, that's it. So I wanted to ask you about revealing personal things about your own history in a memoir, but also personal things about other people's histories, and how that was for you in writing this book.
Oh, boy. I haven't had any horrible phone calls yet. I'm told by Jan it was a loving memoir. You know, I think it mostly is.
Yeah.
I think to a certain extent I might have told stories that were too personal to people. But I didn't know how not to, is my problem.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted it to be an honest book. I told as much on myself as I told on anybody else. And as much as possible, like with Annie, I talked to her on the phone and I got facts straight.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to say the wrong thing.
Right.
And with Alan Renslow, I talked to a number of people. Still, I think maybe when they see it in print, it will upset them.
Hmm.
But so far, so good.
Yeah.
So far, so good.
Maybe it'll just make them sort of recall their lives fondly.
I hope so. Although, you know, some of the stuff is, you know, it's pretty sad. Sad mm-hmm. for me too, though.
Yeah, yeah.
That was life.
Now, I was planning to ask you about being a woman at this time. There was a lot of sexual activity with professional contacts, and I wanted to ask you about that in relation to sort of, you know, for example, the Me Too movement today. But then I found this quote, which really gets to it, and I wondered if I could start by reading this quote, and then we could talk from there.
Okay.
You write, "We didn't see ourselves as victims. We were proactive in our sex lives. We were hungry for experience and beat men to it." I'm going to excerpt this. "If it was okay for men, then why shouldn't we?
Yeah.
We sought equality in this way. We felt like we found it. It didn't feel like promiscuity. It felt like freedom. It felt powerful. There was an emotional or even professional cost. If there was, it wasn't apparent, not then. Consequences weren't even on the radar. There was no such thing as AIDS." So that's really interesting to me, and it fits with what I've actually always thought about feminism in the 60s and 70s compared with feminism today. And I'm just wondering if we can talk about that, and if you want to add anything to that I just read.
You know, there's a difference between those times and the times now.
Right.
And I talk to women my age or my generation, and they understand that women today look at it differently, and I can accept that. But I was telling somebody else today that, you know, I saw an old friend, kind of my age, a little younger, at a funeral, actually.
Okay.
At a funeral. And we were talking about this very subject, and she said that in our day, a mother would say to a daughter, don't go home with a drunken sailor.
Okay.
That was the advice. Now, these young women, like my lawyer niece, think that you should be able to go home with a drunken sailor, and if you say no, he's supposed to, even though he's drunk, listen to you.
Yes.
You know, good luck with that, number one. And number two, I just think, okay, fine. My real belief is that women have to look out for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's not always possible. I know that maybe getting a job is worth endangering your body and yourself. I just can't really believe, it's hard for me to accept that. It's hard for me to believe. I think women have to look out for, look, I'm pounding the table. Can you hear it? It's hard for me. I want to tell women to look out for themselves. Don't let anybody touch you.
Right.
You know, don't take any, you know, and don't take any guff from anybody.
Yeah.
Don't take it. But it's easier for me to say. I just never ran into it, frankly.
Yeah.
And when a man did, you know, push himself on me and I didn't want him to, I pushed him away.
Yeah.
But it was at a party, so it was easier to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the man was a dog. There's no question about that. And he was in a position of power, but not over me.
Yeah.
So I can't really speak to the other. I just never had that relationship with men where I would cede power to them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But my husband gets annoyed with me about this, and you know, because he thinks I'm not sensitive enough to other women who've had this happen to them.
Well, all you're saying,
I'll have to leave it there because obviously it's fraught for me, this subject.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Great.
No, I mean, I'm glad to talk about it. I'll talk about it all night.
Well,
obviously, you can see I'll talk about anything all night, but yeah.
To me,
it's an important topic.
Well, to me, it sounds like what you're saying is this was my experience, and this is the experience upon which I can form my opinions, and you know, that's where I start. So that makes sense.
Yeah. You know, that said, I think we all need to take a deep breath and understand the collateral damage of everything that's gone on with all of this. But I think it's a very good thing for women to advance, you know, in any way.
Right.
So I'm all for it.
I'm changing subjects again here. I found it interesting that you mentioned getting a sick feeling when you have to turn anything in, and that was so interesting. I can understand that you might have had that feeling early on, but it sounds like you still get a sick feeling when you have to turn like an article in, or maybe drafts of this book to your editor. I don't know.
Anything. Drafts of the book were torture. Torture. Just because you just don't know what you've done.
Right.
You know, you can love it, but, you know, you want the other person, you want somebody to like it. I've been surprisingly sanguine with about, there was a review in the UK that was critical.
Okay.
I saw the person's point of view about a few things. They called me, I forget what they said, but I didn't forget it, actually, and I'll never forget it. But I could see the point of view, but I thought it was wrong. I thought it was not right. It didn't bother me as much as you would think, given, you know, how sick I get when I hand something in. You'd think that I would really, sense of what I'd written would depend on others' opinion of it. But I've yet to have a really scathing review, so check back with me if that happens.
Well, it sounds a little bit, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but here I go. It sounds like you get sick when you have to give it to somebody who you respect. Is that possibly?
When I have to give it to somebody, I didn't hear the last part.
That you respect.
Oh, yes. That I respect or who has, you know, power over me,
right.
Like an editor.
Right.
An editor can say, this is terrible. We can't print this. That's possible. You know, that went through my mind like, what? What is this? Because you just do the whole thing and then you give it to them.
Right.
You know, 9 months worth of work. I didn't have that experience, but until she got back to me, I was definitely sick.
Yeah.
Asked my husband. Sick with worry. And actually, I didn't understand the publishing world, and that it might take, you know, more than overnight for, you know, it's a long thing they have to read, so maybe they'd want to read it over the weekend.
Yeah.
But I was so upset that I said, I think he said, you know, you got to go somewhere. I got on a train and I went to a spa.
Oh.
Just to get away, because I was just all nuts, you know, and I got the email from my editor on the train that she loved it.
Oh,
and then
fantastic.
I was jaunty jolly as if, you know, nothing had ever happened. So that's how craven a writer is, this particular writer is.
Yeah.
Frightened. But I don't think this. I'm the only one that experiences this.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see. I'm skipping ahead a lot in the book, but eventually you go to work in television, and some of this book deals with a subject I find really interesting, which is the way in which The Sopranos changed television. And so there you were again, right at the forefront of something. I mean, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
You were always
just like
there.
Selling, yeah.
I know, right? Yeah. So
selling, yeah.
Can you talk about this, about how The Sopranos changed television?
Well, look, you know, we had read the pilot and all of its permutations. I'd worked with David before, become a friend, and you know,
and this is David
in private. David Chase, who created The Sopranos,
right?
And we were working actually with him. We were trying to develop a show, because we would meet with him and talk about the show that we wanted to do. And meanwhile, we would be reading all these the permutations of the script of The Sopranos, and all of them for network without swearing and nudity, and for cable with both of those things. They were all wonderful. I'd never read anything like it before, and I had been involved in quality television. So Year in the Life was quality, and Northern Exposure was certainly quality.
Yes.
But this was something else entirely. This was just so out of the box, and we were working, you know, David had made the pilot and didn't go to series. HBO, there was just, they had until December, and they weren't saying anything, and this was, I think, September. So David said, you know, you guys, he had asked us if the show went, if we would be on it, if we would come to New York and go on the show.
Yeah.
We said, sure, of course. And we took another job. We were working in network TV, where the order for episodes is twice as large, so you're paid by the episode. But when David's show did get picked up in December, we were let out of our contract at the network show, and we had a half-pay cut because there were only 12 episodes to do. But we didn't care. It was never about the money. It was really about wanting to do this hilarious, we thought, show. We'd seen the pilot. David had his own screening for the pilot. We'd never seen anything like it. We thought it was the best thing we'd ever seen. We just loved it. It was falling in love. And so we did that whole year just in obscurity, because it didn't air until it was all done. So we had no idea if it was going to be successful or not. But everyone on that show, every single one of us, actors and writers, knew. We just did it for the sheer joy of it. It was just a joy. And it showed in the work. And then lo and behold, it came out, and it did change television forever.
It really did.
The timing was right for it, and it was so fresh, and it surprised people. And it was good. I don't know, what can you say other than it was just really, really, really good.
Right, it was exceptional.
And the effect that it had, I'm sorry?
It was exceptional, yes.
It was exceptional for its time, and it brought it made television respectable in a way to a certain brand of writer who was just drawn to the movies because of what you could do there creatively.
Right.
That they now saw that you could bring that same sense of excitement and creativity to the small screen, as it used to be called.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
The small screen just didn't seem so small anymore.
Right.
And it was great to be part of that. It was life-changing, actually.
Right, and now you see so many actors who never would have been on television because they had already reached the point in their career where they were considered to be theater, cinema, you know, movie actors. And now a lot of these people are very happy to have quality television shows.
Well, there's a lot of good work to do. There's good work for writers, and there's good work for actors.
Right.
And there's a lot of it. And for a writer, you know, book publishing takes a really long time. I was like, what's wrong with you people? If this were TV, this would be out last week.
I know,
you know?
Right? Yeah,
But it's a different process, and there's so much to it. But for a writer in television, you write the stuff, and boom, you're seeing it filmed. You're seeing casting your actors, and you're down on the set, and you're seeing your words perform, and it's thrilling.
Yeah.
It is thrilling. It was for a very long time.
Let's see. I want to know if you have a favorite Sopranos episode that you worked on, and if you have a favorite Rolling Stone article that you wrote.
Yes,
okay.
I do.
What are they?
I have several favorite Soprano episodes. I guess I'm going to have to say Oh, gosh, it's so hard to choose one.
You may have two. You may have two.
But you know, well, I know, but, you know, it isn't, it's an obscure episode, but it was the first time that as a writer I ever fired a gun.
Oh, wow.
And it was when... It was when Pavarti, Tony's sister,
yeah.
Janice,
yes.
shoots Richie.
Is that her husband?
Yeah. Well, they were going to get married.
Okay.
And Richie, they were arguing, or maybe she was bugging him, and he punched her.
Yeah, they're in the kitchen. They're in the kitchen.
They're in the kitchen,
that
and he
was,
punched her in the mouth,
that was
and
the,
he made her bleed.
That was the best.
It was wonderful. And so he went down, and he went into the dining room and sat at the dinner table. And she was, you know, her lip was trembling, and she was, and he said, what are you going to do, cry now? And she had gone out and she had gone to the TV and gotten a gun from behind it, and she shot him.
Yeah.
What are you going to cry now? Kaboom! That was really fun. And then my favorite Rolling Stone one was the Dennis Hopper piece, just
okay.
because, you know, it kind of put me on the map. And I was proud of it. It just came out good.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because it was one of those situations where in the moment you felt like you weren't going to have anything, and in the end you had something much better than a standard, boring back and forth about what he thinks about, you know. I mean, you already
yeah.
had seen his narcissistic film. You didn't really care what he thought about anything else. So.
Well, I didn't want to hear it again, that's for sure. But, yeah, I never really... You know, I always had that feeling that I didn't think I was going to be able to pull it off. But
no.
I think that, you know, I always, when I teach, I tell kids that, you know, if I look back, I wish I hadn't been so anxious because it all worked out really okay. But would it have worked out okay if I hadn't been anxious?
Right.
And that's the conundrum. That
yeah.
is the conundrum that young people face. It's, you know, it makes you anxious not knowing the future.
Right, right.
At least that was my experience.
Now, Robin, we're winding down. I can wrap this up if you need to go. If not, I've got a few more questions. Is that?
I'm done with my classes for the day and my meetings, so I'm yours if you want
okay.
or whatever you need.
It's just a little bit longer. I'm curious if you read Rolling Stone today.
Oh, dear. I subscribed when I started all this, and I thought I would, but I'm not really reading I shouldn't say this because I love magazines, but for some reason I'm not reading magazines as much.
Yep.
I'm more back into books.
Okay, that was my next question. Have you read any books lately that you would recommend to listeners?
Oh, I always draw a blank when people ask.
I know, everybody does. It's terrible.
It's so funny because I do. There's a million books. And I'm not going to be able to remember the name of the poet, but she's the poet laureate of Mississippi.
Oh.
Her initials are like B.F., F is in Frank Forrester or something. The book is called Heating and Cooling. It's a memoir, but it's really not. It's just the most wonderful little green volume you've ever seen in your life, and I've given everybody a copy of it. And why I can't remember that it's criminal almost, and I should be Googling it right now, but it'll take too long.
Wait, I am.
But
is it Natasha Trethewey?
Say it again?
Is it Natasha Trethewey?
No.
Oh, no, she's
no.
the... No, she's...
No,
she was
Heating and Cooling.
She was the poet laureate earlier. She's not anymore.
Oh, okay. No, it's not a dead person. It's very current and very lively. Because I read mostly memoirs. Writing this book, that's all I really felt like reading. But I read Rachel Kusk's new novel, of course. I can't resist that. And then I went back and bought all her other books and all her memoirs and stuff. Gee, what else? I have a whole stack of books. I read Lean In, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I read some of that. I read Comey's book. You know, I really try to read that stuff. But
yeah.
Really, I love to read novels more and memoirs. And memoirs, I'm loving. I can't explain why. I guess it's a stage that I'm going through.
Okay, great. And then are you working on any books now, or what are you writing next?
Well, that's a good question, and one I ask myself, because we'll be going down to St. John, and if I don't have something to work on, I'll go insane. And also, I loved writing this book so much, I want to do another one, but
this
you know,
was your
I can't
first
live
one,
another,
right?
This is my first book ever.
Yeah. Okay.
And I loved writing it.
Yeah.
I loved it. I loved the process of it. I loved immersing myself for that amount of time, and I loved writing. And for you to say that you liked my writing,
yeah,
is just the greatest thing I've ever heard, because I loved writing it. I loved it.
Yeah,
I want to do it again. I just don't know what.
Well, you'll figure something out, I'm sure.
I hope so.
Okay, let's see. So I wanted to ask you if you have any advice for women who are hoping to break into journalism, media, writing jobs today.
Gee, I can't give advice on this subject.
I mean, I'm
free to, but I just don't know the landscape out there.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like print, I don't know, you know. I don't know how a writer is supposed to make a living anymore.
Yeah.
I don't recommend my, falling into things by accident method, because it's kind of chancy. But
Do you recommend bringing your dog to the interview?
Sorry, I probably just blew your microphone.
No, that's fine.
Maybe.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes, bring your dog. Definitely.
Or at least wear purple.
Especially to like an uptight newspaper.
There you go.
Definitely bring your dog. I don't know. I would take any job somewhere and work my way into it. I know people get into TV a lot like that, just do secretarial work until they find an opportunity. I didn't, of course, but it's fine if you do. I didn't in television. I just got a chance and I made good on it. But you never know where your chance is going to come from.
Right.
Just have to keep open to opportunity, I think.
Right. Right. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, you know what else?
What's that?
I know. Here's advice. Nothing good ever happened to me unless I was working, and I mean supporting myself.
Right.
It's important to work, I think.
Okay.
Is that true? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty true. That all of the good things that happened to me, I had like one job in the daytime and I would do something else at night. I just took any opportunity. And because the great opportunities that came along were not from things that I would have thought. They were just sort of out of the blue, but connected to something I was doing.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
I do. Yeah.
I was writing restaurant reviews at night, and the person that invited me into television read one of those reviews, you see, and I was just doing that for fun,
right?
Not for any kind of ambition. So, I guess that's the accidental nature of how I've proceeded.
Yeah.
I can't recommend it. I take it back.
No, it's good. It's good, because if you keep working, then
keep your sense of humor. That's another thing.
Now, there's no pressure on this, because some people say, no, I don't have anything. But every week I do ask my guest if they have a writing prompt or an exercise or an activity that they can recommend for listeners who are writers. And if not, I come up with something on my own. But I was curious if you have anything like that.
An exercise that you could do?
Or an activity or a writing prompt. I mean, sometimes people will just come up with something very specific, like describe the kitchen of your childhood. But people say all different things, so I don't know.
I can't even imagine.
Okay.
But if you ask me next week, I'll have something. No, I don't... I'm a kind of writer who just needs to know exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So I would give myself an assignment if I wanted to do an exercise, write an essay about killing your first deer.
Okay.
Which I did in December.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did.
Wow.
I eat meat, so I felt I should.
Yeah, there's a great book called the, what's it called? His last name is Cerulli, and it's about somebody. It's a memoir about that exact thing, feeling like. Yeah. It's something carnivore. Oh, my goodness.
Carnivore is in the title? Because I can find out.
Carnivore is in the title. It's Tovar Cerulli is the author's name. It's quite good. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to read it, because I had trouble with this essay. But that's a good suggestion. Give yourself an assignment, write an essay.
Yeah, I like that. That's great.
Send it into a newspaper and get it published, right?
Excellent. Okay, yeah, so give it a try. All right, so listen, I just want to mention one more time that I've been speaking with Robin Green. Her book is The Only Girl, My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone, published by Little Brown. And Robin, it's been a real pleasure. I've really enjoyed talking to you about your incredible book.
So much fun. Thank you so much.
Oh, and do you have a website?
No.
Okay.
I don't.
But people can learn more about your work at Little Brown, probably.
Yes, they should go to the Little Brown, definitely. Little Brown has all sorts of information. And even if they just type in the title of it, all sorts of stuff comes up. And the reviews have been really wonderful.
That's fantastic. Congratulations.
I can send them there and happily.
Yeah, that's wonderful. All right. Well, listen, Robin, it's been a pleasure.
It's been so much fun. Thank you.
Okay, I'm still with you. And from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And that was an interview with Robin Green, who has a new book with Little Brown, The Only Girl, My Life and Times on the Masthead of Rolling Stone. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show, or if you have some news about book-related events that you'd like read in the Bookworm's calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you enjoy Write the Book, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.